Part 2 of Chapter 7 of John Brown by W.E. Burghardt Du Bois. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. It was John Brown's hope that the courage engendered by the striking success of the fight at Blackjack would spread the spirit of resistance to the whole Free State Party. Lawrence, then the capital, was still surrounded by a chain of forts held by bands of pro-slavery marauders, one at Franklin just east of the city, another just south and known as Fort Saunders, and a third between Lawrence and the pro-slavery capital, Lecompton, known as Fort Titus. When it was rumored that the United States troops would disperse the Free State Legislature about to meet at Topeka, John Brown hurried thither, hoping that resistance would begin here and sweep the territory. One of the Free State leaders met him at Lawrence and journeyed with him toward Topeka. Brown and he took the main road as far as Big Springs, he says, and continues, "There we left the road, going in a southwesterly direction for a mile, when we halted on a hill, and the horses were stripped of their saddles and picketed out to graze. The grass was wet with dew. The men ate of what provision they had with them, and I received a portion from the captain, dry beef, which was not so bad, and bread made from corn bruised between stones, then rolled in balls and cooked in the ashes of the campfire. Captain Brown observed that I nibbled it very gingerly, and said, 'I'm afraid you will be hardly able to eat a soldier's harsh fare.' We next placed our two saddles together so that our heads lay only a few feet apart. Brown spread his blanket on the wet grass, and when we lay together upon it, mine was spread over us. It was past 11 o'clock, and we lay there until 2 in the morning, but we slept none. He seemed to be as little disposed to sleep as I was, and we talked, or rather he did, for I said little. I found that he was a thorough astronomer. He pointed out the different constellations and their movements. 'Now,' he said, 'it is midnight,' as he pointed to the finger marks of his great clock in the sky. The whispering of the wind on the prairie was full of voices to him, and the stars as they shone in the firmament of God seemed to inspire him. How admirable is the symmetry of the heaven! How grand and beautiful! Everything moves in sublime harmony to the government of God. Not so with us poor creatures. If one star is more brilliant than others, it is continually shooting in some erratic way into space." He criticized both parties in Kansas. Of the pro-slavery men, he said that slavery besotted everything and made men more brutal and coarse. Nor did the Free State men escape his sharp censure. He said that we had many noble and true men, but too many broken-down politicians from the older states, who would rather pass resolutions than act, and who criticized all who did real work. A professional politician, he went on, you never could trust, for even if he had convictions, he was always ready to sacrifice his principles for his advantage. One of the most interesting things in his conversation that night, and one that marked him as a theorist, was his treatment of our forms of social and political life. He thought that society ought to be organized on a less selfish basis, for while material interests gained something by the deification of pure selfishness, men and women lost much by it. He said that all great reforms, like the Christian religion, were based on broad, generous, self-sacrificing principles. He condemned the sale of land as a chattel, and thought that there was an indefinite number of wrongs to right before society would be what it should be, but that in our country, slavery was the sum of all villainies, and its abolition the first essential work. If the American people did not take courage and end it speedily, human freedom and republican liberty would soon be empty names in these United States. Early next morning, the party pressed on until they came in sight of the town. Brown would not enter, but sent a messenger ahead. And the narrator continues, "As he wrung my hand at parting, he urged that we should have the legislature meet, resist all who should interfere with it, and fight, if necessary, even the United States troops. He had told me the night before of his visit to many of the fortifications in Europe, and criticized them sharply, holding that modern warfare did away with them, and that a well-armed, brave soldier was the best fortification. He criticized all the arms then in use, and showed me a fine repeating rifle, which he said would carry 800 yards. But, he added, the way to fight is to press to close quarters." The Topeka journey was in vain. The legislature quietly dispersed at the command of Colonel Sumner, and John Brown saw that his only hope of stirring up effective resistance lay in Lane's army of immigrants, then approaching the northern boundaries of Kansas, with whom was his son-in-law's brother. Taking, therefore, his wounded son-in-law and leaving his band, he pressed forward alone on a dangerous and wearisome way of 150 miles through the enemy's country. Hinton saw him as he rode into one of the camps, and says, "Have you a man in your camp named William Thompson? You are from Massachusetts, young man, I believe, and Mr. Thompson joined you at Buffalo." These words were addressed to me by an elderly man riding a worn-looking, gaunt gray horse. It was on a late July day, and in its hottest hours. I had been idly watching a wagon and one horse, toiling slowly northward across the prairie, along the emigrant trail that had been marked out by Free State men under command of Sam Walker and Aaron D. Stevens, who was then known as Colonel Whipple. John Brown, whose name the young and ardent had begun to conjure with and swear by, had been described to me. So as I heard the question, I looked up and met the full, strong gaze of a pair of luminous, questioning eyes. Somehow I instinctively knew this was John Brown, and with that name I replied, saying that Thompson was in our company. It was a long, rugged-featured face I saw. A tall, sinewy figure, too, he had dismounted, 5'11", I estimated, with square shoulders, narrow flank, sinewy and deep-chested, a frame full of nervous power, but not impressing one especially with muscular vigor. The impression left by the pose and the figure was that of reserve, endurance, and quiet strength. The questioning voice tones were mellow, magnetic, and grave. On the weather-worn face was a stubby, short gray beard, evidently of recent growth. This figure, unarmed, poorly clad, with coarse linen trousers tucked into high, heavy cowhide boots, with heavy spurs on their heels, a cotton shirt opened at the throat, a long torn linen duster, and a berayed chip straw hat he held in his hand as he waited for Thompson to reach us, made up the outward garb and appearance of John Brown when I first met him. In 10 minutes, his mounted figure disappeared over the north horizon. Pushing on northward, Brown found asylum for his wounded follower at Tabor, Iowa. Returning, he joined the main body of Lane's men at Nebraska City. Here again arose divided councils. Radical leaders like Lane and Brown were proscribed men, and United States troops stood on the borders of Iowa to prevent the entrance of armed bodies. It was decided, therefore, that Lane must not enter with the immigrants, and a letter to this effect was brought to him by Samuel Walker, a Free State leader. Walker says, "After reading it, he sat for a long time with his head bowed and the tears running down his cheeks. Finally, he looked up and said, 'Walker, if you say the people of Kansas don't want me, it's all right, and I'll blow my brains out. I can never go back to the States and look the people in the face and tell them that as soon as I got these Kansas friends of mine fairly into danger, I had to abandon them. I can't do it. No matter what I say in my own defense, no one will believe it. I'll blow my brains out and end the thing right here.' 'General,' said I, 'the people of Kansas would rather have you than all the party at Nebraska City. I've got 15 good boys that are my own. If you will put yourself under my orders, I'll take you through all right. Thus Walker, Lane, and John Brown, with a party of 30, stole into Kansas and started anew the flame of civil war. Brown's old company, organized early in 1858, was mounted and brought to the front, and a systematic effort was made by Lane to free Lawrence from its beleaguering forts. The first attack was directed against Franklin on the night of August 12th, and as ex-Senator Acheson of Missouri indignantly reported, 300 abolitionists under this same Brown attacked the town of Franklin, robbed, plundered, and burned, took all the arms in town, broke open and destroyed the post office, captured the old cannon Sacramento, which our gallant Missourians captured in Mexico, and are now turning its mouth against our friends. 2 days later, the little army turned southward to Fort Saunders. Lane deployed his forces before it, with John Brown's cavalry on his right wing. A charge was ordered, and the garrison fled to the woods, leaving an untasted dinner and large stores of goods. On August 16th, Fort Titus, on the road to Lecompton, was besieged with cannon and finally fired by a load of hay. Colonel Titus, a Georgian, was captured, and John Brown and other leaders wanted to hang him, for he was one of the most brutal of the Border Ruffian commanders. Sam Walker, however, saved his neck. So furious had been this short campaign that the pro-slavery party sued for a truce. Walker tells how, on the following day, Governor Shannon and Major Sedgwick came to Lawrence to negotiate an exchange of prisoners. They held about 30 of our men, and we 40 of theirs. It was agreed to swap even, we surrendering all their men, including Titus, they to hand over all our men, and cannon they had captured at the sacking of Lawrence. I insisted very strongly on this last point of the contract, for when the gun was taken, I swore I would have it back within 6 months. I had the pleasure of escorting our prisoners to Sedgwick's camp, and receiving the cannon and the prisoners held by the enemy there in exchange. The whirlwind of guerrilla warfare now swept back to the dark ravines of the Swamp of the Swan. After the murders of May came the first counterattack of early June, culminating in the Battle of Blackjack. This check quelled the pro-slavery party a while, and they began manning the forts around Lawrence. On August 5th, the Free State men struck a retaliating blow while John Brown was absent in Nebraska, although he was credited with being present by the Missouri newspapers. Similar skirmishes followed, and the advantage was now so completely with the Free State forces that a final crushing blow was planned by the slave party of Missouri. Manifestos swept the state, and "no quarter" was the motto. The Missourians responded with alacrity, and a great mass crossed the border divided into two wings. The lesser attacked Osawatomie, and a newspaper in Missouri said, "The attack on Osawatomie was by part of an army of 1,150 men, of whom Acheson was major general. General Reed, with 250 men and one piece of artillery, moved on to attack Osawatomie. He arrived near that place and was attacked by 200 abolitionists under the command of the notorious John Brown, who commenced firing upon Reed from a thick chaparral 400 yards off. General Reed made a successful charge, killing 31 and taking 7 prisoners. Among the killed was Frederick Brown. The notorious John Brown was also killed by a pro-slavery man named White in attempting to cross the Marais des Cygnes. The pro-slavery party have 5 wounded. On the same day, Captain Hayes, with 40 men, attacked the house of the notorious Ottawa Jones, burned it, and killed 2 abolitionists. Jones fled to the cornfield, was shot by Hayes, and is believed to be dead." But John Brown was not dead, and was ever after known as Osawatomie Brown. he wrote home September 7th, saying, "I have one moment to write to you, to say that I am yet alive, that Jason and family were well yesterday. John and family, I hear, are well, he being yet a prisoner. On the morning of the 30th of August, an attack was made by the ruffians on Osawatomie, numbering some 400, by whose scouts our dear Frederick was shot dead without warning, he supposing them to be Free State men, as near as we can learn. One other man, a cousin of Mr. Adair, was murdered by them about the same time that Frederick was killed, and one badly wounded at the same time. At this time I was about 3 miles off, where I had some 14 or 15 men overnight that I had just enlisted to serve under me as regulars. These I collected as well I could, with some 12 or 15 more, and in about 3/4 of an hour I attacked them from a wood with thick undergrowth. With this force we threw them into confusion for about 15 or 20 minutes, during which time we killed or wounded from 70 to 80 of the enemy, as they say, and then we escaped as well as we could, with one killed while escaping, 2 or 3 wounded, and as many more missing. 4 or 5 Free State men were butchered during the day in all. Jason fought bravely by my side during the fight, and escaped with me, he being unhurt. I was struck by a partly spent grape canister or rifle shot, which bruised me some, but did not injure me seriously. Hitherto the Lord has helped me." A cheer went up from all Free Kansas over this vigorous defense, and for once there was unanimity among the leaders of the Free State cause. Robinson, the wariest of them, wrote, "I cheerfully accord to you my heartfelt thanks for your prompt, efficient, and timely action against the invaders of our rights and the murderers of our citizens. History will give your name a proud place on her pages, and posterity will pay homage to your heroism in the cause of God and humanity." Meantime, the Missourians, after their hard-won victory, hastened back to join the larger wing of the invaders, and so disconcerting was their report that when Lane made a feint against them, they started to retreat. Governor Woodson's call for the territorial militia, however, heartened them and gave them legal standing. By September 15th, they were threatening Kansas again with nearly 3,000 men. The nation, however, was now aroused, and the new governor, Geary, with orders to make peace at all costs, was hurrying forward. Among the first whom he summoned to secret conference was John Brown. Brown came to Lawrence and was leaving, satisfied with Geary's promises, when the invading army of Missourians suddenly appeared before the city. He immediately returned to the town, where there were only 200 fighting men. He was asked to take command of the defense, but declined, preferring to act with his usual independence. About 5 o'clock, Monday the 15th, he mounted a dry goods box on Main Street, opposite the post office, and spoke to the people. "Gentlemen, it is said that there are 2,500 Missourians down at Franklin, and that they will be here in 2 hours. You can see for yourselves the smoke they are making by setting fire to the houses in that town. Now is probably the last opportunity you will have of seeing a fight, so that you had better do your best. If they should come up and attack us, don't yell and make a great noise, but remain perfectly silent and still. Wait until they get within 25 yards of you. Get a good object. Be sure you see the hind sight of your gun. Then fire. A great deal of powder and lead and very precious time is wasted by shooting too high. You had better aim at their legs than at their heads. In either case, be sure of the hind sights of your guns. It is from this reason that I myself have so many times escaped, for if all the bullets which have ever been aimed at me had hit me, I would have been as full of holes as a riddle." It was a desperate situation. The Free State forces were scattered, leaving but a handful to face an army. But in that handful was John Brown, and the invaders knew it, and advanced cautiously. Redpath, who was with Brown, says, "About 5 o'clock in the afternoon, their advance guard, consisting of 400 horsemen, crossed the Wakarusa and presented themselves in sight of the town, about 2 miles off, when they halted and arrayed themselves for battle, fearing, perhaps, to come within too close range of Sharp's rifle balls." Brown's movement now was a little on the offensive order, for he ordered out all the Sharp's riflemen from every part of the town, in all not more than 40 or 50, marched them a half mile into the prairie, and arranged them 3 paces apart, in a line parallel with that of the enemy, and then they lay down upon their faces in the grass, awaiting the order to fire. The invaders hesitated, halted, and then retired. John Brown says, "I know of no possible reason why they did not attack and burn that place, except that about 100 Free State men volunteered to go out on the open plain before the town and there give them the offer of a fight, which they declined after getting some few scattering shots from our men, and then retreated back toward Franklin. I saw that whole thing. The government troops at this time were with Governor Geary at Lecompton, a distance of 12 miles only from Lawrence, and notwithstanding several runners had been to advise him in good time of the approach or of the setting out of the enemy, who had to march some 40 miles to reach Lawrence, he did not on that memorable occasion get a single soldier on the ground until after the enemy had retreated back to Franklin, and had been gone for about 5 hours. He did get the troops there about midnight afterward, and that is the way he saved Lawrence, as he boasts of doing in his message to the bogus legislature." This was just the kind of protection the administration and its tools have afforded the Free State settlers of Kansas from the first. It has cost the United States more than 500,000 for a year past to harass poor Free State settlers in Kansas and to violate all law and all right, moral and constitutional, for the sole and only purpose of forcing slavery upon that territory. I challenge this whole nation to prove before God or mankind the contrary. Who paid this money to enslave the settlers of Kansas and worry them out? I say nothing in this estimate of the money wasted by Congress in the management of this horrible, tyrannical, and damnable affair. The withdrawal, however, was but temporary, and it seems hardly possible that Lawrence could have escaped a second capture and burning had not Geary thrown himself into the breach with great earnestness. As he reported, "Fully appreciating the awful calamities that were impending, I hastened with all possible dispatch to the encampment, assembled the officers of the militia, and in the name of the President of the United States, demanded a suspension of hostilities. I had sent in advance the Secretary and Adjutant General of the Territory, with orders to carry out the letter and spirit of my proclamations, but up to the time of my arrival, these orders had been unheeded, and I discovered but little disposition to obey them. I addressed the officers in command at considerable length, setting forth the disastrous consequences of such a demonstration as was contemplated, and the absolute necessity of more lawful and conciliatory measures to restore peace, tranquility, and prosperity to the country. I read my instructions from the President, and convinced them that my whole course of procedure was in accordance therewith, and called upon them to aid me in my efforts, not only to carry out these instructions, but to support and enforce the laws and the Constitution of the United States." Without doubt, Geary especially emphasized the fact that another sacking of Lawrence would possibly defeat Buchanan and elect Fremont. What chance would there be then for the pro-slavery party? The Missourians were thus induced to retreat, partly by Geary's logic, partly, perhaps, by John Brown's resolute handling of his patently inadequate but nevertheless efficient force. They marched back home, leaving a trail of flame and ashes, the last and largest Missouri invasion of Kansas, the culmination and failure of the pro-slavery policy of force. Geary now began successfully to cope with the Kansas situation. His most puzzling problem was John Brown and his ilk. His experience soon led him to see the righteousness of the Free State cause, but he had to insist on law and order, even under the bogus laws, promising equitable treatment in the future. Immediately, the Free State Party split into its old divisions. The small body of irreconcilables like John Brown, who were fighting slavery in Kansas and everywhere, and the far larger mass of compromisers, like Robinson, whose only object was to make a free state of Kansas, and who were willing to concede all else. Under such circumstances, the best move was to get rid of John Brown. To have sought to arrest him would have precipitated civil war again. Could he not be induced quietly to leave on promise of immunity? Accordingly, Geary issued a warrant against Brown, but gave it into the hands of the friendly Samuel Walker, whom he had previously asked to warn the old man. Brown was not loath. His work in Kansas, so far as he could then see, was done. The state was bound to be free, and further than that, few Kansans cared. They had no enmity toward slavery as such, which called them to a crusade. Far from regarding Negroes as brothers, they disliked them, and were willing to disfranchise them and crowd them from the state. Among such folk, there was no place for John Brown. His greater mission called him. Kansas had been an interlude only, although for a time he hoped to make it the chief battleground. Now he knew better, and again the Alleghenies beckoned. To be sure, he owed Kansas much. Here he had passed through his baptism of fire, and had offered the sacrifice of blood to his God. He was sterner stuff now, ready to go whithersoever the Master called, and he heard him calling. Not only had he learned a method of warfare in Kansas, he had learned to know a band of simple, honest young fellows, hot with the wine of youth, hero worshippers, ready to do and dare in a great cause. Thus the worst difficulties of the past disappeared, and the way lay clear. Only one thing oppressed him. He was old and sick, a tired, toil-racked man. Could he live and do the Lord's will? His company of regulators was formally disbanded, but left spiritually intact, and he started north late in September 1856, taking with him his four sons, John Jr., who had at last been released, Jason, Salmon, and Oliver, and also, true to his cause, a fugitive slave whom he had chanced upon. As he moved northward, the United States troops, unaware of Geary's diplomacy, shadowed and all but captured him. Yet he passed safely through their very midst with his old wagon and cow and the hidden slave, displaying his surveyor's instruments. Thus, silently, John Brown disappeared from Kansas, and for a year nothing was heard of him in his former haunts. Only his near friends knew that he had gone eastward, and a few of them hinted at his great mission. Matters moved swiftly in Kansas. There was, more and more evident, a free state majority. But would the pro-slavery administration let it be counted? The new governor was trying to save something for his masters, but the irreconcilables of the Lane and John Brown type doubted it. "I bless God," wrote Brown in April, "that he has not left the free state men of Kansas to pollute themselves by the foul and loathsome embrace. I have been trembling all along lest they might back down from the high and holy ground they had taken. I say, in view of the wisdom, firmness, and patience of my friends and fellow sufferers in the cause of humanity, let the Lord's name be eternally praised." Notwithstanding this attitude of many of the Free State Party, they were prevailed upon to vote in the state election of October 1857. As a concession, however, Lane was appointed to guard the ballot boxes. and hearing that John Brown was back again in Iowa, he sent for him in hot haste. His messengers found the old man sick and disappointed among his staunch Quaker friends at Tabor. Brown offered to come if supplied with 3 good teams, with well-covered wagons, and 10 really ingenious, industrious, not gassy men, with about $150 in cash. These demands were not met until too late, so that Brown returned the money and did not appear in Kansas until the election was over and the Free State forces had triumphed. This had now but passing interest for him. He had other objects in Kansas, and flitted noiselessly about among the picked men who had promised their aid. Then he disappeared again. 8 months passed away, when suddenly another Kansas outrage startled the nation. It was the last vengeful echo of that first night of murder in the Swamp of the Swan. In 1856, Linn and Bourbon counties, some miles below the original Brown settlement, had been cleared of Free State settlers. In 1857, these settlers ventured to return and found the pro-slavery forces centered at Fort Scott, waiting for Congress to pass the Lecompton Constitution. Thus, in 1857 and 1858, the expiring horror of Kansas guerrilla warfare centered in southeast Kansas. The pro-slavery forces saw the state slipping from them, but they determined by desperate blows to plant slavery so deeply in the counties next Missouri that no Free State majority could possibly uproot it. To accomplish this, it was necessary again to drive off the Free State settlers. The settlers objected, and, led by James Montgomery, there ensued a series of bloody reprisals, culminating in May 1858, 2 years after the first May massacre. A Georgian, with a remnant of Buford's band, again rode down amid the calm, silent beauty of the Swamp of the Swan. They gathered 11 unarmed farmers from their fields and homes and marched them to a gloomy ravine near Snyder's blacksmith shop. There the party killed 4 and badly wounded 6 others, leaving them all for dead. The echoes of this last desperate blow had scarcely died before John Brown appeared on the scene and attempted to buy and fortify the very blacksmith shop where the murders were done. He writes to Eastern friends, "I am here with about 10 of my men, located on the same quarter section where the terrible murders of the 19th of May were committed, called the Hamilton or Trading Post murders. Deserted farms and dwellings lie in all directions for some miles along the line, and the remaining inhabitants watch every appearance of persons moving about with anxious jealousy and vigilance. 4 of the persons wounded or attacked on that occasion are staying with me. The blacksmith, Snyder, who fought the murderers, with his brother and son, are of the number. Old Mr. Hargrove, who was terribly wounded at the same time, is another. The blacksmith returned here with me and intends to bring back his family onto his claim within 2 or 3 days. A constant fear of new trouble seems to prevail on both sides of the line, and on both sides are companies of armed men. Any little affair may open the quarrel afresh. 2 murders and cases of robbery are reported of late. I have also a man with me who fled from his family and farm in Missouri but a day or two since, his life being threatened on account of being accused of informing Kansas men of the whereabouts of one of the murderers, who was lately taken and brought to this side. I have concealed the fact of my presence pretty much, lest it should tend to create excitement, but it is getting leaked out, and will soon be known to all. As I am not here to seek or secure revenge, I do not mean to be the first to reopen the quarrel. How soon it may be raised against me, I cannot say, nor am I over anxious." He quickly had 15 of his former companions in arms organized as Schubel Morgan's company under the old regulations, and he eagerly sought out and cooperated with Captain Montgomery. The vigil was long and wearisome. I had lain every night without shelter, he writes, suffering from cold rains and heavy dews, together with the oppressive heat of the days. Hinton met Brown at this time, and found him not only unwell, but somewhat more impatient and nervous in his manner than I had ever before observed. Soon after my arrival, he remarked again in conversation as to the various public men in the territory. Captain Montgomery's name was introduced, and I inquired how Mr. Brown liked him. The captain was quite enthusiastic in praise of him, avowing a most perfect confidence in his integrity and purposes. Captain Montgomery, he said, is the only soldier I have met among the prominent Kansas men. He understands my system of warfare exactly. He is a natural chieftain, and knows how to lead. Of his own early treatment at the hands of ambitious leaders, to which I alluded in bitter terms, he said, "They acted up to their instincts as politicians. They thought every man wanted to lead, and therefore supposed I might be in the way of their schemes. While they had this feeling, of course they opposed me. Many men did not like the manner in which I conducted warfare, and they too opposed me. Committees and councils could not control my movements, therefore they did not like me. But politicians and leaders soon found that I had different purposes, and forgot their jealousy. They have all been kind to me since." Further conversation ensued relative to the Free State struggle, in which I, criticizing the management of it from an anti-slavery point of view, pronounced it an abortion. Captain Brown looked at me with a peculiar expression in the eyes, as if struck by the word, and in a musing manner remarked, "Abortion? Yes, that's the word." "For 20 years, he said, "I have never made any business arrangement which would prevent me at any time answering the call of the Lord. I have kept my business in such a condition that in 2 weeks I could always wind up my affairs and be ready to obey the call. I have permitted nothing to be in the way of my duty, neither my wife, children, nor worldly goods. Whenever the occasion offered, I was ready. The hour is very near at hand, and all who are willing to act should be ready." During the fall, John Brown cooperated with Montgomery in his guerrilla warfare, and laid out miniature fortifications with his men. While he himself was not personally present in Montgomery's fights, he usually helped plan them, and sent his men along. Meantime, winter set in, and John Brown knew that hostilities would cease. Once again, he turned to his long and exasperatingly interrupted life work. Just after the famous raid on Fort Scott, he had a chance not only to begin his greater work, but to strike a blow at slavery right in Kansas. Hinton says, "On the Sunday following the expedition of Fort Scott, as I was scouting down the line, I ran across a colored man, whose ostensible purpose was the selling of brooms. He soon solved the problem as to the propriety of making a confidant of me, and I found that his name was Jim Daniels, that his wife, self, and babies belonged to an estate and were to be sold at administrator's sale in the immediate future. His present business was not selling of brooms particularly, but to find help to get himself, family, and a few friends in the vicinity away from these threatened conditions." Daniels was a fine-looking mulatto. I immediately hunted up Brown, and it was soon arranged to go the following night and give what assistance we could. I am sure that Brown, in his mind, was just waiting for something to turn up, or, in his way of thinking, was expecting or hoping that God would provide him a basis of action. When this came, he hailed it as heaven sent. John Brown himself told the story in the New York Tribune. "Not 1 year ago, 11 quiet citizens of this neighborhood, William Robertson, William Culpetzer, Amos Hall, Austin Hall, John Campbell, Asa Snyder, Thomas Stilwell, William Hargrove, Asa Hargrove, Patrick Ross, and B. L. Reed, were gathered up from their work and their homes by an armed force under one Hamilton, and without trial or opportunity to speak in their own defense, were formed into line and all but one shot, 5 killed and 5 wounded. One fell unharmed, pretending to be dead. All were left for dead. The only crime charged against them was that of being Free State men. Now, I inquire what action has ever since the occurrence in May last been taken by either the President of the United States, the Governor of Missouri, the Governor of Kansas, or any of their tools, or by any pro-slavery or administration man, to ferret out and punish the perpetrators of this crime. Now for the other parallel. On Sunday, December 19th, a Negro man called Jim came over to Osage Settlement from Missouri and stated that he, together with his wife, 2 children, and another Negro man, was to be sold within a day or two, and begged for help to get away. On Monday, the following night, 2 small companies were made up to go to Missouri and forcibly liberate the 5 slaves, together with other slaves. One of these companies I assumed to direct. We proceeded to the place, surrounded the buildings, liberated the slaves, and also took certain property supposed to belong to the estate. We, however, learned before leaving that a portion of the articles we had belonged to a man living on the plantation as a tenant, and who was supposed to have no interest in the estate. We promptly returned to him all we had taken. We then went to another plantation, where we found 5 more slaves, took some property, and 2 white men. We all moved slowly away into the territory for some distance, and then sent the white men back, telling them to follow us as soon as they chose to do so. The other company freed 1 female slave, took some property, and, as I am informed, killed 1 white man, the master, who fought against the liberation. Now for comparison. 11 persons are forcibly restored to their natural and inalienable rights, with but 1 man killed, and all hell is stirred from beneath. It is currently reported that the governor of Missouri has made a requisition upon the governor of Kansas for the delivery of all such as were concerned in the last-named dreadful outrage. The marshal of Kansas is said to be collecting a posse of Missouri, not Kansas, men at West Point in Missouri, a little town about 10 miles distant, to enforce the laws. All pro-slavery, conservative, free state, and doe-face men and administration tools are filled with holy horror. One of the slaves, Samuel Harper, afterward told of this wonderful catabasis of 1,000 miles in the teeth of the elements and in defiance of the law. It was mighty slow traveling. You see, there were several different parties amongst our band, and our masters had people looking all over for us. We would ride all night, and then maybe we would have to stay several days in one house to keep from getting caught. In a month, we had only got to a place near Topeka, which was about 40 miles from where we started. There was 12 of us at the one house of a man named Doyle, besides the captain and his men, when there came along a gang of slave hunters. One of Captain Brown's men, Stevens, he went down to them and said, "Gentlemen, you look as if you were looking for somebody, or something." "Ah, yes," says the leader. "We think as how you have some of our slaves up yonder in that there house." "Is that so?" says Stevens. "Well, come on right along with me, and you can look them over and see." We were watching this here conversation all the time, and when we see Stevens coming up to the house with that there man, we just didn't know what to make of it. We began to get scared that Stevens was going to give us to them slave hunters. But the looks of things changed when Stevens got up to the house. He just opened the door long enough for to grab a double-barreled gun. He pointed it at the slave hunter and says, "You want to see your slaves, does you? Well, just look up them barrels and see if you can find them." That man just went all to pieces, He dropped his gun, his legs went trembling, and the tears most started from his eyes. Stevens took and locked him up in the house. When the rest of his crowd seen him captured, they ran away as fast as they could go. Captain Brown went to see the prisoner and says to him, "I'll show you what it is to look after slaves, my man." That frightened the prisoner awful. He was a kind of old fellow, and when he heard what the captain said, I suppose he thought he was going to be killed. He began to cry and begged to be let go. The captain, he only smiled a little bit and talked some more to him, and the next day he was let go. A few days afterward, the United States Marshal came up with another gang to capture us. There was about 75 of them, and they surrounded the house, and we was all afraid we was going to be took for sure. But the captain, he just said, "Get ready, boys, and we'll whip them all." There was only 14 of us altogether, but the captain was a terror to them, and when he stepped out of the house and went for them, the whole 75 of them started running. Captain Brown and Kagi and some others chased them and captured 5 prisoners. There was a doctor and lawyer amongst them. They all had nice horses. The captain made them get down. Then he told 5 of us slaves to mount the beasts, and we rode them while the white men had to walk. It was early in the spring, and the mud on the roads was away over their ankles. I just tell you, it was mighty tough walking, and you can believe those fellows had enough of slave hunting. The next day, the captain let them all go. Our masters kept spies watching till we crossed the border. When we got to Springdale, Iowa, a man came to see Captain Brown and told him there was a lot of friends down in a town in Kansas that wanted to see him. The captain said he did not care to go down, but as soon as the man started back, Captain Brown followed him. When he came back, he said there was a whole crowd coming up to capture us. We all went up to the schoolhouse and got ourselves ready to fight. The crowd came and hung around the schoolhouse a few days, but they didn't try to capture us. The governor of Kansas, he telegraphed to the United States Marshal at Springdale, "Capture John Brown, dead or alive." The marshal, he answered, "If I try to capture John Brown, it'll be dead, and I'll be the one that'll be dead." Finally, those Kansas people went home, and then that same marshal put us in a car and sent us to Chicago. It took us over 3 months to get to Canada. What kind of a man was Captain Brown? He was a great big man, over 6 feet tall, with great big shoulders and long hair, white as snow. He was a very quiet man, awful quiet. He never even laughed. After we was free, we was wild, of course, and we used to cut up all kinds of foolishness. But the captain would always look as solemn as a graveyard. Sometimes he just let out the tiniest bit of a smile and says, "You better quit your fooling and take up your book." On the 12th of March, 1859, nearly 3 months after the starting, John Brown landed his fugitives safely in Canada, under the lion's paw. The old man lifted his hands and said, "Lord, permit thy servant to die in peace, for mine eyes have seen thy salvation. I could not brook the thought that any ill should befall you, least of all that you should be taken back to slavery. The arm of Jehovah protected us." End of chapter 7.